Welcome to the serial audiobook Pandemic. An unabridged presentation of Book 3 in the Infected Trilogy, written by Scott Sigler and performed by Phil Giganti. This novel is available in print, ebook, or as a full-length uninterrupted audiobook. For links to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Audible, iTunes, and more, please visit scottsigler.com. Hello, junkies. Welcome to Pandemic episode number 42.
42.
Which we never thought we would get to, and yet here we are, episode number 42. It is part two of our Q&A session for not just Pandemic, you guys, the entire Infected trilogy. And oh my gosh, you guys, the questions for episode 41 were scintillating. They were on point. They cut deep. They cut me to my quick, sir. With me today, co-hosting this episode, is none other than A. Kovacs, the director of Doom, A Real Girl herself. Hello, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm going to warn you guys that we started episode one. Yeah, a bottle of wine. No big deal. Bottle of wine. Episode one went 1 hour and 3 minutes of straight hot fire content.
I will say we've been quite busy. It's June 1st. Yeah. We've been quite busy in May.
Yes.
So we had a handful of little victories we were celebrating.
Celebrating.
And, you know, so yeah.
But here's the thing. We recorded part one. It's not like we waited a week. We have rolled right into part two, along with the second bottle of wine. So this is the...
There's no more wine. It's going to be that one.
This is the... what do they call that in Jeopardy? The lightning round where the points really add up?
The daily double.
This is double Jeopardy. This is double wine-ready. And we are now going to dive into our questions with double wine-ready, where you, the junkies who have followed my work for so long, or are new, either way, are going to get to see, wait a minute, we think Scott might be smarter than the average bear. How smart is he when he's into a second bottle of wine and answering deep questions?
We're going to start with Alan Sloan. Alan Sloan, like many junkies, has sent in multiple questions, which is fine.
Okay.
Hi, A and Scott. Love the podcast of Pandemic. Love the series. I met Scott on his book tour in Boston when Pandemic first came out. I hope you both make it back here again, just for fun or in support of a future project.
Yep.
Anyhow, here's my questions.
Hit me.
One, were there any pieces of military tech that you wrote about in this series that are real that you haven't seen in person but would like to?
I have, I'm very blessed in that some of my consultants are able to show me some real pieces of military hardware. But for the most part, I don't actually get to see any of these things in person at all.
Yeah. You know,
I really don't. I'm not military. I have no military background. I rely heavily on my treasured secret agents to give me the perspective of soldiers and sailors and airmen, et cetera. And if we ever need the Coast Guard, we got Mike Cole.
We have lots of people. Yeah.
There's lots of people we can rely on. That is author Mike Cole, writes amazing science fiction military books. Look him up. M-Y-K-E-C-O-L-E. No, I don't get to see almost any of these things. And I'm simultaneously upset. I've never got to live that lifestyle and do other things. And also extraordinarily grateful to the people who have.
Yeah. And you have had a couple of experiences. We both got to see the Boneyard, the Harveys, JP mm-hmm. and Steph Harvey, who JP is one of your secret agents, mm-hmm. Took us through the Boneyard in
Las Vegas.
Was it Nellis Air Force Base?
I think so, maybe.
Which is a lot of other militaries kind of downed planes and stuff.
There are trophies.
They were super great.
The trophies of America's things we have collected from our enemies and now have in a museum.
It was awesome. And
we got to sit in a Hind helicopter.
Yeah, I was just about to say that was so cool. It was very, very cool.
Yeah.
And also you got to go on and that's not equipment, but you got to go through an exercise with Chris Grawl, who's one of your consultants.
That's true.
Who runs the tactical Quill, which is a tactical information for writers. Mm-hmm. And he took you through an FBI training where you were the perpetrator.
I was the perp. I got to be the perp.
How'd that go?
It was great. We got to work with a SWAT team in Florida. Mm-hmm. And when the SWAT team first showed up, I'm not going to lie, I was ridiculously judgmental because of Hollywood. These guys show up And they're not all fucking 6'2 and 6'3 with the, you know, the chiseled jaw.
They don't look like The Rock, all of them.
They don't look like The Rock and the guys you would see in every SWAT movie you've ever seen. They're regular dudes. Like, there was one dude who fit the profile. The rest of them, like, I was so judgmental. I'm like, psh, are you serious? And then the first day we started run through exercises, and Chris and I are paint bullets.
Sure.
Right. So they're not paint balls. They fire actual rounds, but they propel a paint charge. They're very accurate, which I found out the hard way. But first day, Chris and I just tore these dudes up. Like, they did not see us coming from different, we always died. Cause there's seven of them, two of us, but we were able to take out three, four, even five guys.
Wait. Until this very moment, I didn't realize that Mr. Happy is also a perp.
Yeah, he's also a perp. Chris Grell and I were perps.
Well, I didn't know that. Are you kidding me?
So we were able to lay ambushes for people and really help. And I'm like, oh, come on, whatever. I'm assuming I'm in bumfuck nowhere, Florida. And then what you saw was wonderful, because you saw the level of people who get hired to these jobs. They're not hired because they're The Rock. They're hired because they learn really fucking fast. And by day two, it was the beginning of day two, we would get a couple of them. And by the end of day two, even though Chris Grawl, military, three tours overseas, combat veteran, really knows what he's doing, we were lucky to even get one, because these guys learn and gelled so fast, and we would get taken out no matter where we were. It was just a brilliant, it was a lot of, show me my hubris of day one. And by the end of day two, I was like, oh my God, these are some smart motherfuckers. They learned so fast. Which brings me to one point, ladies and gentlemen. If you are ever in a situation, ever, 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 and there is a SWAT team involved, lay down on the floor and put your hands behind your head. These are not people to be fucked with.
By which you mean, lace your fingers behind your head, yeah, so they can tell you have nothing in your hands.
Lay down, lace your fingers. Trust me on this. It will save your life, because they can shoot you between the eyes from 50 feet away in a dark room. It's crazy.
Okay.
I rambled. See, I told you
that's why. That's okay. Speed question.
Yep.
If you had written yourself into the series a la Stephen King in The Dark Tower, would your character have died?
Number one, I would never write myself into a series. Number two, as big of a huge fan as I am of Stephen King, and acknowledge that he is an absolute master of his craft, and acknowledge that he's probably the reason I have this career, I have not read a Stephen King book since that moment. I folded up that book, put it away, never read. I did go read Dr. Sleep because I wanted to see how that story turned out. But that was,
so I
that was
ask,
a man who was so moment, bored being successful, he had to come up with something.
Is that moment when Stephen King showed up on a main road, on a road in rural Maine, and a van drove by? Is that the moment you're talking about when Stephen King wrote himself into the book?
I'm talking about in the Gunslinger series.
Yep.
At some point, the characters from the book sit down and have a cup of Java with actual Stephen King. And I was completely out. It wasn't just breaking the fourth wall. It was a completely different thing.
It's so intimate, and it is yet so...
You know what? But it's one of those things. I'm sure other authors have done it, but no one of Stephen King's caliber has done that technique, and he's bored. He's just bored.
Well, that was hard for me in a different way, but that was still okay. So here's another, I think maybe not a speed run question, but maybe. What was the most difficult scene for you to write in pandemic, and why?
The most difficult scene for me to write in pandemic was clearly Margaret, because...
Which scene?
The scene where... Clarence Otto decides he has to be the one to end Margaret's life, because there's so much going on in that scene. He absolutely adores her. He stood by her.
And he knows she's gone.
He knows she. And then he was, at some point, he had stuck with her as long as he could. And if you guys are in your 20s, you might not get this. If you're in your 30s, maybe in your 40s, you probably understand it. Your perspective starts to change on things as you get older. And you can ride or die with people for a long time.
A long time.
But then you get to a point in your life, you're like, okay, I have more days behind me than I have ahead. And the days I spent with this person have not been happy. So I have to make a call. Do I ride with this person and be unhappy for that limited bit of existence that I have? Or do I part ways and try and see what little happiness I can carve out of life in the limited time that I have left? Mm-hmm. And that is something that I have been through on a personal level. And not the only one. A lot of people have been through it.
Right. I've been there.
But to watch Clarence Otto have to make that call in the beginning of the book, like, I've done everything I could, and you are not going to work to help yourself. So at this point, I have to choose. Do I stick with you?
And we both go down?
We both go down, or do I try and make something for myself? He does that, and then almost immediately, she's called back into action, and he has second thoughts about that.
Yeah.
And then he has the third thoughts at the end, which are...
Because... Oh, which screwed. Are?
Well, the third thoughts, then he has to step up and be... Yes, step up and be a true lover, a true spouse, like
and a true human. Has to really balance all the things in his life to make the best decision he can at the time. And there is no good decision.
There's no good decision.
Which, you know, I recently have done a lot of these things you just mentioned myself, mm-hmm. and realized life is short, and sometimes it's hard, and sometimes it's fraught, but it's also really glorious and happy. And what do you choose? And sometimes it's a choice, and sometimes it isn't, and sometimes it's hard. However, Clarence has a moment or two or 17 where he has to be like...
It's difficult. There's a choice he has to make. Do you follow the path of duty? And do you stick with the person that you have pledged yourself to, who is absolutely not committed to getting better? Just not committed to it at all. Mm-hmm. Or do you realize at some point, yeah, you did everything you could and your work here is done, and you go on. But then he gets to the end of the book and near the end of the book, and he kind of realizes, number one, that's not his woman anymore. That's not Margaret Montoya. That's a different person.
Margaret, which is so hard.
Margaret's gone.
Yeah.
And then Clarence does this straight baller thing where he's like, I'm not going to let anybody else do this. If there's anything left in her, I'm going to be the one to finish that off, because that's my spouse. I'll do this.
Yeah.
And he has to kill her at the end of the book, like by hand, and not just kill her, harvest her. He has to kill her in a way
and save humanity.
Kill her in a way that the most of her can be collected for this other purpose.
Yeah.
In effect, she's slaughtered like cattle at the end of the book. And he has to be the one to do it. So that is the most difficult part of the book to me. I was bawling. I had to rewrite like all 5-6 drafts of this thing. I was bawling through that scene. Just try and imagine doing that to somebody. It's akin to if you've got someone that you love, like your parents at some point, somebody gets to that point where they're in vegetative state and somebody has to make the call to pull the plug. The doctor doesn't feel bad. The nurse doesn't feel bad.
I think they feel bad. They don't feel bad on the level that you do.
No, because there is a person in the family who has to make the decision. I'm ending this life right now, and I'm doing it. Clarence just did it in a crazy, up-close and personal way with a knife.
So, question for A, who was your favorite character in Pandemic and why? I think for me, my favorite character still, after everything you just said, my favorite character should be Clarence, right? He does the terrible, difficult thing.
Does the hard work.
Yeah. He chooses humanity over himself. And yet my favorite character is Perry, who doesn't really even show up in Pandemic, right? He shows up as himself in a dream sequence with Margot. And what happens is he's doing something he has done that me as a reader, I have seen him do verbatim in previous books. So she's truly just remembering a moment and she's sharing it with me, the reader. Mm-hmm. And he is being consistently himself. And you know, people who die prematurely, people who you believe have more in them and then they go away, like all those people you believe are better than they are. And one of the charming things for me about Pandemic, I mean, there's a lot I love about Pandemic. I really love Cooper too. But Perry is exactly himself verbatim that he was in other books, and it forces you to be like, oh yeah, you're remembering him super fondly. Remember him for exactly who he was, which was kind of a little selfish and also a little aggressive and also very fun and good. And yeah, and that's so hard because we do that all the time. We'd like to remember ourselves more fondly than we were before. So I love that part about Perry. And I know he's only in the very early stages of Pandemic, but I love that. That's my favorite thing.
Cool. What's our next question?
Okay, let's see.
Part two, you guys. Rock and roll.
Nick Batdorf says, thanks for all the stories you write, and I can't wait for another book. Now, I got a question that goes between two of your books. Okay. In Pandemic, Murray Longworth is talking about experiments on cures for the contagion for the hydras and the primates that couldn't be infected. Since the lab working on the lot of the testing is on Black Manitou Island, and the ancestors were created for their organs to be transplanted into humans. Could they be infected with the contagion? Thank you, Nick Baddorf.
Nick, the contagion only can operate on sentient creatures. There's a higher level of intelligence. So to answer your question, I'm going to have to say, I can't tell you until I write Descendant. And right now, A. Kovacs is shooting eye daggers at me.
Eye daggers, really?
But someday, hopefully, I will write Descendant, and the answer to your question will be in the sequel to Ancestor. That's all I got for you, bro. That's it.
Do you hear me?
That's clacking the nails on the computer.
Yeah. Okay, Glenn Hughes.
I'm not promising I'll write it. I'm just saying it would be great if I could.
I agree with all of that, and I would like to know that story. Glenn Hughes says, "Hi, Scott. Back in the first act of Pandemic, there was a scene where it was disclosed that the infection had developed the ability to migrate through the fabric of the scientists' hazmat suits. Was it Clarence Otto whose suit was breached? I wish it was easier to scan back through the audiobooks, but
I see, that's a problem.
I was expecting more of a payoff from this plot point, but soon after,
He missed it. I agree.
But soon after, the external events took over and it seemed like it was never developed. Did I miss something or was it never fleshed out? Keep up the good work.
You missed Margaret Montoya getting infected. That's how Margaret got infected.
Yeah, that's what's important about that. We watch Clarence worry about it and miss the moment that Margaret has, that she gets infected.
Yeah. We get down to the microscopic level and there's, at that level, we're completely oblivious to what's going on. At the microscopic level, her suit gets penetrated and we watch this vector sneak in through her suit and infect her. And if you go back and listen to it again, dude, it's worth your time because now you understand when you see that scene, that's Margaret getting infected. And then you watch Margaret's path from there on and it will make a lot more sense to you.
It just kills me because she goes to sleep herself and wakes up gone. And it just kills me.
Tough times for the hero of the world. Tough times.
Brian Johnson says, greetings.
Brian Johnson. From AC/DC.
Brian Johnson.
Brian Johnson, AC/DC.
Greetings, Scott and A. From your number one fan in Knoxville, Tennessee. Congratulations on the Pandemic podcast. I really enjoyed it and am looking forward to the new release of Earthcore. Here is my question.
Okay.
At the very beginning of the book, you talk about the creators, those who made the probe. Can you elaborate on who the creators are? You say that they programmed the probe and many others with the sole purpose of finding intelligent species and exterminating dimensional gates.
Mm-hmm.
Why go through so much trouble? Why not drop the Andromeda strain and just kill everyone? Well, are the creators interested in habitable worlds at all? Just curious. Thanks.
There's a couple answers to that. Number one, everybody's always interested in territory. Territory is in new lands are the anchor for all expansionist empires.
Habitable territory.
Habitable areas. Well, not even necessarily habitable. Resource-rich areas.
Resource-rich.
Without new lands to conquer, empire-based economies collapse. There's only so much you can do with what's already in place. You have to keep going out and getting new stuff. I think I lost the thread of his question now at that point. So that's the first part of the question. What was the other part?
How many habitable...
Go back and just read it again. Scan over for me. Sorry, guys.
Can't do
two bottles of wine.
Hang on.
No, you guys have to wait. She's going to call it up again. Here we go.
Can you elaborate on who the creators are?
Can I elaborate on who the creators are? No, I cannot elaborate on that. And they're not...
Why go through so much trouble to send probes?
Okay.
Why not drop the Andromeda strain?
The Andromeda strain is... Believe it or not, Michael Crichton's Andromeda strain is a higher tech than we're dealing with in my stories. That is a level of technology that can go in and figure out how to wipe out an entire species as opposed to figuring out how to go in and alter a species in order to make new parts of a species. Comparable to, in my technology, it is how do they go in and change the Lego house into a Lego castle, right? These are parts we make different parts. in Michael Crichton's, it's how do we take the Lego house and melt all the fucking plastic, make all the plastic melt itself.
Mm-hmm.
So they have some elements of that, but other elements that they don't have. So we're going to assume there's a technological barrier, discovery barrier. They're not sure they can get. I think if they could have done the Andromeda strain, they absolutely would have done the Andromeda strain. So the purpose of the gate was to wipe out an intelligent species, take over the planet, have more resources for the empire. That is what they were after. It didn't work out for them.
Adam King asked, you mentioned previously that the books fit into the history of the Galactic Football League series. I just wondered, with that in mind, does mankind ever discover the alien race that sent the probe? Do they catch up and interact in one way or another? Just curious as to what would likely be an interesting first contact.
I will stop that and I'll ask A. Kovacs a question. Who sent Christopher Columbus? What government?
Spain.
Are we pissed at the Spaniards right now?
No, but that's not what he asked.
It's kind of what he asked.
I mean, he asked, do we know? We don't know. Like, we're still answering that. Are the key the people who came through? Is the orbital all that?
I guess I paraphrase this question, is 700 years on, it doesn't make for that big of a deal. Yeah. People know, historians know, they know the full story, which you don't know as a reader. And the historians don't know the full story either. There's trillions of sentient creatures in the GFL era, trillions. It's a massive number. There's a lot going on. There's a lot that gets lost the more the population grows.
Sure.
So there are elements of the story that probably will not be brought out unless I someday get to write that book.
All right. I'm going to ask this question from Matthew Victory. Two books
so far I have to write based on this episode alone.
Yeah. So Matthew Victory has sent in this question. Dear FDO and Director of Doom, I would like to know what happened with the 6-hour P226 Margaret used to kill Bogdana.
Okay.
The P226 is a semi-automatic pistol that is designed to chamber the next round from the magazine after firing. This being the case, when the automatic pistol is designed to chamber the next round... Oh, sorry. Clarence checks the magazine of the gun to kill Bogdana, and he should find 10 rounds in the magazine, not 11, on page 496. Assuming the weapon was empty when the magazine was inserted, the first round would be chambered after loading, leaving 11 in the magazine. This was the round used to kill Bogdana. After firing, the second round would be chambered, leaving 10 in the magazine, yet Clarence finds 11. Please provide a bullshit-free answer. Respectfully, Matthew.
Matthew, I believe the answer is going to be, why is he assuming the gun was completely empty when the magazine was inserted?
Even so...
Well, if it's 12 in the mag, 1 in the chamber, that's 13.
Well, he's saying there's...
He's saying there's 12 in the magazine. I don't have the book in front of me, so I'm going...
Yeah, based, I mean, I think I'm the big answer him. Here, I will answer this question, and he may think this is a bullshit answer, and that's fine. The answer here is you are focusing on one tiny little section of 180,000 words, and this may have been an oversight that nobody caught.
It could be an oversight. It's also fun. It's also fun to go through.
It's exactly fine if that's the answer. Matthew, however, I would like to make sure that you're not saying I think there's 12. I don't know how many rounds are in the chamber.
Right. We're going off of, we don't have one in front of us, don't have the book in front of us, don't have my research in front of me, don't have a P226 in front of me. So we're going to say if it's a 12, I believe we're saying, we're going to answer this, we'll move on. 12 rounds in a mag, there was already one in the chamber, 13, which I think then if you fire one, there's 12. Then if it chambers the next one, pull out the magazine, there's 11. So that's what we're going to go with. That is my best attempt at a no bullshit explanation for the question you ask. I could be wrong. It's possible we could have fucked it up.
Right. And I think that's what he's after.
Yeah. But I think if there's already one in the chamber, I think that answers all his questions. So my email, can email send us?
Sure. If he wants to.
Yeah. Email info@empty.set. Tell us if we got a sufficiently bullshit-free explanation to answer your question. If not, that's okay. Let us know.
Brian Powell says, what inspired your concept for, quote, the bull, end quote? Was it a cross between the Hulk and Baraka from Mortal Kombat? That's the way I pictured it in my head.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Also, will you ever have a book that explains how O'Doyle loses his ear? Maybe he goes head to head with Magnus?
That's awesome. Believe it or not, I have never once thought about a story that explains how O'Doyle lost his ear.
Well, now you have.
So now I have, I don't know if we'll get to it, but we'll see. We can work that into many short stories that people are asking us to write.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
I'm fascinated by bioengineering and reconfiguring the human process or any biological process by which to make new material. And a new one of the materials we're constructed of is bone. Bone is a fantastic weapon. You know, you've got claws, which aren't necessarily bone, but bone is super hard, super dense, powerful. If you could figure out a way to engineer living creatures to produce bone as a weapon, that is a spectacular, wonderful weapon. So the inspiration for the bulls was largely, basically take a really large bodybuilder, and that is a person who has evolved themselves, so to speak, into something that maximizes human potential. And if you get a big enough frame, frame determines your mass. If you are 5'4", there's a limitation on how big you can get as far as how much you can weigh and still be athletic, still be muscular. If you are 6'4", there's an exponentially larger number involved. So what we're looking at in pandemic is, how do we expand the framework of the human body, which is the skeletal structure? How do we add on the layers of dense muscle on top of that to maximize strength and speed? And if we make things proportionally bigger, we can pack on so much more muscle, and then we can add the most natural weapon that's available, which is bone. So that was largely the inspiration. It wasn't really, I understand your analogy or what you saw. I don't think it was inspired by that, but I can't say for sure. As a creator, a lot of times you see a glimpse of something and it just embeds in your subconscious and you don't even know until it comes out and somebody says, hey, was it this thing? You're like, oh fuck, I guess it was that thing. I didn't know I was writing it. I don't think it was that. It could be, but largely it was like, how do we weaponize the human body? How do we make something that is so unbeatable? It's like facing a 6-foot velociraptor. You guys ever seen a velociraptor in a museum? If you've actually seen one, you realize there's zero survivability. And they're only like 4 feet tall.
Okay, from Dana Stoll, I have this. Hello, Scott. Hello, A. Great story. Great conclusion to a fantastic trilogy. Mm-hmm. I have a question for the Q&A episode.
Hit me.
Tim Feeley is a freaking great character.
Thank you.
I liked him so much more in Pandemic than I did in Ancestor. And I think that Phil and you did an amazing job of conveying his personality in the podcast. My question is, what are the chances of seeing good old Dr. Feelygood in a short story about some event he is having to cover in his directorship role? Or even better, a novella about all the good doctor, either all backstory or covering his directorial debut. Thank you so much for all the years of entertainment. Dana Astor.
First of all, if I ever write Descendant, you will see Dr. Tim Feeley again. And it'll be super fun because that'll be the one character you know who's going to live. Because Descendant takes place immediately after Ancestor.
Mm-hmm.
I said this in the podcast before. That will be the one, or at least the first break in the Siglerverse timeline where the day of publication is the day the story begins, because I have to go back to Ancestor. It's a throwback. Second of all, God, I hope we see him in his director role. I really want to have a story where you get to see him at some point. Murray Longworth has to die at some point, and you're going to watch Tim step up and take that godfatherly role, the godfather of biotechnology for, you know, like the monster hunter. There's always that, every Jonathan Mayberry story, there's always that guy lurking in the background who's kind of controlling things.
Yeah,
you know, and we're going to see Tim in that role, except Tim's going to be a bit more vulgar, a bit more inappropriate, and always trying to get laid. Always, always, always trying to get laid.
Okay, from Richard Feliciano. He says, I loved this series and this book. Contagious was my first Sigler book, and I became hooked. So my questions concern the aliens who sent the probes.
Okay.
They do not seem to be part of the GFL universe yet.
No, they're not.
Am I correct that there have been clues I may have missed?
Yes, there... Go ahead.
It seems unlikely that the Earth alone would have been the sole planet to encounter or survive a probe visit.
Me first answer your question by saying this. Shooting out probes in random equidistant directions from a spherical object like a planet means you are looking for a needle in a haystack. Even though radio signals will propagate forever and gradually get weaker the farther they go out from the original source, the odds of detecting them, one of them, when you look at the distances involved in the universe, are astronomically unlikely. So it's not necessarily, it's not a situation of how far are, is the Earth from the place the probes were launched. Is the probe in the right place at the right time when a civilization sends out radio waves that they are strong enough that that probe can home in on the radio waves?
Which is such a cosmic unlikelihood.
Yeah. And it's real. And I've read some Asimov story, nonfiction on this, and it's mind bending for me. So, I mean, just in general, if you're not a mathematician, if you're not an astrophysicist, trying to comprehend the distances and the time involved is mind bending. So I know enough to be able to tell you that just the closest thing is not necessarily the thing that will be detected, because it's not just distance. It's where people are in the timeline of the evolution of a technology to send out radio waves.
Right.
So, I got that part of the question.
I think that is enough.
That answers it.
Yeah.
So it's what it is. The answer is it's a fucking crapshoot.
Yeah.
Let me get eloquent on you. It's a fucking crapshoot and the Earth just happened to get screwed.
David Stubblefield says, great book as always, great closing to the series. My question is, there is no mention of Petra in this book. Mm. She had a quick appearance in Ancestor where they talked about the nuke in Detroit from Contagious.
Yep.
Though she might appear since she was part of the Special Threats Unit. I'm not sure. Can you mention that? Thank you, David Stubblefield.
He's talking about Petra Prawat, who is the progenitor, the creator of the Prawat race, which is a story that hopefully I'll be able to tell someday.
Hang on one sec. Yep. Also, Adam Ledford asked a similar question. He said, I've been waiting for another Petra Easter egg. Did I miss it? Are you, Scott, going to write another story in the timeline to cover Petra's story?
I desperately want to write the origin of the Prawat race. And I intentionally left out any Easter eggs or direct reference to her in Pandemic because what happened... I have to weigh... the spoiler alert. What I will say is this, the creation of the Prawat race in the format that you will see in the GFL is very secretive and very hidden. And it is largely an altruistic effort by an individual that goes horribly, horribly wrong. So what happens after Ancestor is shit you won't see until that story comes out. And hopefully I'll get to write that story. Otherwise, it'll just be a mystery.
Okay, I have a giant spoiler here. I feel so strongly about I need to tell you guys again an hour into the second episode. This is a giant spoiler.
Okay, hit me.
Bill Cripps says, holy fucking shit, Clarence slitting Margaret's throat to get her blood and spray it all over the fucking infected is epic. Mm-hmm. Fucking epic.
Thank you, sir.
I have been listening since almost the very beginning to your podcast and writing career, and the Infected trilogy is by far my favorite. I'm almost sad to see it come to an end, but wouldn't end it, it says. I can't wait to see how Earthcore rewrite finally plays out. Thank you, FDO. Bill Cripps.
More of a statement than a question.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks, Bill.
Tom Rockwell, also known as Devo Spice.
Devo Spice. Really? Fabulous.
Yeah. This is probably,
the world famous Devo Spice.
Yeah. I seem to remember you mentioning in the past, producers have passed on turning the GFL into a TV show or movie because it would become too expensive. That is understandable. I was wondering if you've ever considered pitching it as an animated series.
Oh, that's exactly where I think it'll wind up someday. Animated, computer generated. As a live action series, it'll never happen. We would need to have George R. R. Martin numbers to make that happen, and we simply do not. But I do think at some point we'd love to get it as an anime. You know, I'd like to see CGI come a little bit farther, where the middle level of CGI is like those are convincing, realistic looking aliens. Doesn't have to be all the way where it's 100% realistic because we forgive a lot as watchers. We don't care.
We do. We forgive a ton.
Nothing proves this more than the movies on Sci-Fi, the Sci-Fi Channel movies. You don't need top-notch special effects if you have a great story, great characters, great actors, great director. So I think that's what we'll eventually get with the GFL. Anime would be cool. CGI would be better. I go back to the old Starship Troopers CGI series as a reference if you know that. But hopefully we'll see it someday because, man, I think it's a great story.
Mm-hmm. Brad Burton has written, and he's asked a handful of questions. He sort of answered one. Have you ever considered turning this into a series or partnering with Netflix or Hulu? And I'm going to answer that one. I totally get that people are like, oh shit, no, I really would like to see this on XYZ channel.
Us too.
Yeah, us too. If any of you guys who are thinking, have you guys talked about anime? Have you guys talked about Netflix? Have you guys talked about CBS? Trust me, if you have any connection there, if you have any idea. Also, if you just think about it, please still send those questions. But rest easy that we are literally trying to talk to whoever we can talk to. Mm-hmm. And we're literally happy to take any contact and any meeting that might move that ball forward if you actually have that information. Now, I'm not saying you should email CBS and say, talk to Scott Ziegler. I am saying if your cousin is a talent manager at Hulu, please let us know that.
Hook us up. Hook a brother up.
But yes, the short answer to all those questions is we've considered all the Infected trilogy, all the Generations trilogy, all the GFL, all Hunter Henderson.
We're slinging 24/7, you guys. Yeah. We are hunting all the time.
We have done that for movies, for TV, for animation, for right. web series, for comic books. We've done all that, and we will continue to do it until we get more content into more people's hands. However.
D1 bound.
Yes. If you have any specific information about that, or you just want to remind us that anime is out there, that's still cool. Email that information to info@emptyset.com.
Yep.
Okay, let's see. I think we may be kind of wrapping up. There are many people who have sent in multiple questions, but they kind of overlap a little. So
okay.
Geek Acres, Doug, who I adore.
Doug's great.
Says, with Netflix constantly producing content like Stranger Things and 13 Reasons Why, does this up the chance of seeing the Siglerverse on the small
Absolutely,
screen?
Absolutely, totally ups the chance. There's more markets now. You even go back 10 years, there were still other markets, but not many. Just go back one decade. There were four markets, and now there are a dozen. You know, there's Hulu, there's Xbox Live, which eventually is going to come around and start doing great stuff. There's Amazon, there's Netflix. There are all the cable channels that are now very aggressive in going out and getting original content. So you're looking at this, I've said this multiple times and there's multiple parameters to it. This is the best time in the history of mankind to be a creator of original content. And it's, guys, it's only a matter of time. The only variable is time. You will see a show by A&I on TV. You will see it in your lifetime. It's totally coming. We don't know when, but it's coming, and more markets make it more likely. And we are always hunting. We're hunters. We want to put TV executives on the hood of our car and drive through town and honk our horn.
I mean, I don't necessarily
shoot our guns into the air.
You don't even have a car.
I don't have a car, but if I had one, I'd put a TV executive on the front of that hood, put an apple in his mouth, and I'd roast him up for barbecue for lunch.
So say,
yeah.
Big John Vizcarra has just the one
Jesus
question.
Christ.
Just the one question.
Here we go.
Just the one question. Margaret Montoya was a very strong female protagonist in the first two books in the Infected trilogy. In book three, she starts out as a shell of her own self, then regains her old vim and vigor.
Yep.
But eventually progresses into becoming a scheming antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
In the process of determining who will fill these roles in your story, do you struggle at all with preserving such a strong history of a character, or do you revel in building someone up only to tear them down at the very end?
It totally depends on the situation, the character, and the plot. You guys got to remember, once I start these books, I mean, I have everything outlined, I have a general structure, I know how the big ending happens, but during the iterations of 4, 5, 6, 7 drafts, sometimes things happen and things like Perry buying it in Contagious, totally not planned. I did not expect that was going to be the end of the story.
And would you have chosen that as an architect?
Of course
when
not.
When you were outlining back in the day?
No, he was a great character. But you get to the end of that book and you're like, oh, this is the way it plays out. So now I can make a choice. I can screw the reader. And I can all of a sudden have, oh, we forgot about this one super fast, supersonic helicopter that can swoop in and grab him, get him out of there. Or we can tell an honest story. And Margaret Montoya is a casualty of telling an honest story where bad shit happens to good people. And she, her number was up and she had to go.
I will say that John ended his email by saying, this question sounds way more bitter than I meant it to.
I know, right?
Which I agree, right? And I think you do too. That idea of, are you kidding me? After literally 300,000 words or more, she is doing this to me?
400,000.
she's doing this to me and to everyone else. It's tragic. And yet there's a certain beauty in you being like, yeah, apparently she is. She's going to do this and I'm going to write it and it's going to suck and people are going to hate it. And yeah, I kind of love that.
It sucked for me. It sucked for me to write it. I wanted her to go on and do great things, but she, like everyone, everything you know, everything you love, everything's going to die and character's no exception.
Everything will die someday. That's true. Okay, Paul Stevenson writes, my question, do you ever regret wrecking the world in this trilogy? Does it make it harder now to tell stories set in the current timeline in the Signalverse? Mm-hmm. How can you play with your toys if you destroy your playground? And this is why we can't have nice things.
Paul, read EarthCore. Listen to EarthCore. Buy the audiobook, buy the ebook. You will see the beginnings of how I rebuild Nagasaki as a parallel to the Siglerverse.
So I would like to mention that Matthew Roth emailed a very intricate question about the key and the gate in the future and all that stuff. And I'm not going to read that whole question because I kind of feel like you talked about the key coming through the gate a couple of times over the last two episodes. But okay. I wanted to recognize his thoughtful question anyway and say, I think we may have answered it, although he might disagree. And then you wanted to end with Ariok, maybe?
Is this the last one?
Yeah, I think so. Oh, so we have a couple of audio questions, and I don't know what Rogers are, but Rogers asked a handful of questions, and then you wanted to end with Ariok.
Let's see if we can cue up Ariok. He got us the two questions. Guys, hang with us. This is live radio. A's going to try and cue up, see if Ariok has another voice change, because we goofed on his question in Q&A episode number one. He sent in a very long, well thought out, well acted, well audio effective question.
Supernatural. It certainly appears that episodic, witty, supernatural action is a cash cow in human culture at the present time.
Yes, I'm listening.
The current market seems to have embraced them as the next procedural cop show.
Okay, okay.
If a studio hasn't picked it up yet, one will soon.
Oh, this is
the only variable is time.
He's
talking about Supernatural.
Well, he's comparing Supernatural to Hunter Harrison and Sons, which is how his last question ended, I think.
Sure.
So, yes, it is, but we'll talk about this briefly. If only to pay credit to the work you put in this call, everything in Hollywood is cyclical.
Yeah.
You know, there's very rare that you get an original thing. And right now, what is the original thing? Stranger Things. What is Stranger Things? It's fucking E.T. It's not original at all. I love the show.
It is. It's just original in its execution. Its concept is not original.
It is an 80s throwback. All the stuff from the 80s. It is totally cashing in. Like, it's like the White Stripes. Or the Black Keys. We're cashing in on a sound that has already been done and a look and a feel has been done, but nobody's done it for a while and now we're bringing it back.
Right. And we're doing it in a new way. Like, we're not literally coming back with Ziggy Stardust. We're coming back with someone that echoes Ziggy Stardust that maybe has a star in its face, not a lightning strike.
It's Ziggy Stardust who's 22 instead of 42. Is what it is.
And it's a little different, and I think I don't mind so much the paying homage part.
I don't mind it at all.
I mean, I think that Stranger Things hasn't been done before because I've never met Barb, right? Like, that's a new, unique angle to that. Not to say this is a new, unique idea. Mm-hmm. It's an execution of ideas that I've seen a ton of.
The milieu we've seen this milieu before. Exactly, and it's novel and creative and original. Why? Because no one has reinvented that shit before until now.
Right.
So you can look at Stranger Things and say, hey, that's derivative. That's a copy of this whole gestalt we had back in the 80s. Or... great, if it's derivative, why hasn't somebody else done that in the last 15 years? Nobody's done it. These guys did it. Therefore, it feels good. It's a good thing.
I feel like if it feels like home, and even if it's derivative, it feels like home and keeps my interest, all in.
Which it did.
But, you know, example is the shot for shot remake of Psycho.
Flat.
That's just the thing. It's such a lightning strike, right? It is literally a shot for shot remake. So part of you expects Vince Vaughn to do something different. And Vince Vaughn is paying homage and doing exactly. It is published. It is known. He's doing a shot-for-shot remake.
It's the weirdest thing, right? We always bitch like, oh, they're going to do a remake. I want that remake to be just like the original. And then we get one that's just like the original. Right. The psycho shot-for-shot remake.
And here's why I think that exists. That's exactly where I was headed with this. I think that exists because we bring our own experience to our own life history to that experience. Mm-hmm. So for you, like for me, I love the remade Psycho, right? But I didn't see the original Psycho. I'm way too young to have seen that in the theater. But I love the shot for shot remake because I believe that that's an important movie, the original. And I love the idea of the honoring of the past, right?
So you like the shot for shot remake?
I love it. I love it, love
what,
it, love it.
What? Okay.
I'll tell you exactly why. Okay. Because I am a tech snob. I'm a huge tech snob when it comes to movies. And I can't stand a Muslim set.
What is a Muslim set? Muslin.
Muslin, that's what I'm saying.
Yes.
Yeah, is muslin on plywood. And I can see it shake in the background.
Things painted on a background that's easily detectable as a background.
Exactly.
Okay.
And some of that exists in the original Psycho because that's that time of history that's how that was done. And I love that that doesn't exist in the new one. There's a million things I love. It made the original a tiny bit different, but not really different, but also a tiny bit better, but not really better, right? It's trying really hard to do something good. And what I love about it is it illuminates that what is important about a thing you love is that you love it. Mm-hmm. So it's not about whether or not it's Vince Vaughn or Anthony Perkins. It's how you feel about them. And that's a thing we miss all the time. So sometimes we say, I don't want to see a remake. And sometimes we say, I can't wait to see a remake. I hope they do it just like the original. That has nothing to do with the art. It has to do with your experience with it. And I love that. And so I think that people find that a lot with your work, especially we get a lot of email about people who feel like they're so confined to their very little shallow silo. I am a forensic scientist that only deals with urine. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden there's a thing in Nocturnal that only they know. And they feel like you're talking to them. And I find that very, very compelling. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the more we can embrace with that kind of entertainment, the more exciting it is. And that's why we get great Q&A episodes like this where people ask very integral, very granular questions because it is important to them. And so I would like to do that a lot more. But we're not going to do a third Q&A.
No. I think we're at 47 minutes into Q&A part two. I think we're at the end here. What do we have left? What do we have?
We just have three questions.
We
have three emails from Roger Graham, who's already, in the first one, we answered a question.
I did. Roger was dope.
Would you like me to just pick one more and we'll be done?
No, let's do all three. Let's knock this shit out.
Okay.
Because if they're listening by now, 47 minutes into part two of the Q&A, they like us. You really like us.
All right, this is Roger asking. He says, sorry for so many submissions, but these things sometimes happen.
These things happen, buddy. It's my phrase
of my
life.
I'm halfway through binge re-listening to Pandemic, and I realized one of my previous questions was dumb. Bopan dies of an aneurysm on screen, but it's a little more in the footnote, so that answered that question.
Okay.
Once again, the curse of Gary Detweiler strikes. Remember, kids, say no to hanging out with Gary Detweiler.
Do that.
Okay, that wasn't really a question, but we'll go back and find out the first one.
The Detweilers are not to be trusted.
This is also Roger.
Roger, hit me.
Okay, last question this round, I swear. Bobby Jewell, Bobby Brobst, Bobby Valentine, Bobby Pigeon. Why so many Bobbies?
I don't know.
I do.
That's a good question. Why?
Because Bobby Jewell and Bobby Brost really exist. Do Bobby Pigeon or Bobby Valentine?
Bobby Pigeon does. Yeah, that's an actual fan.
Those are real human people.
I think Bobby Valentine might be. Maybe three. At least three out of the four are real, genuine Sigler
fans.
The
reason is because surrounding you right this minute in your own life are many, many Bobbies.
They're everywhere. The fucking Bobbies are everywhere. I don't even live in London, and the fucking Bobbies are everywhere.
We've been trying to tell you.
I've been trying to tell you. I was going to say, you know what I was going to say? I've been trying to tell you to kill the Bobbies, but then some jackass will go kill a Bobby, and that's my fault.
We don't want that.
Dude.
I mean, unless they're trying to kill
I've been trying to tell you for a long time, buy the Bobbies a beer because they're awesome.
It's way better.
Thank you.
Way better.
I like
Here's the last question. Roger Graham gets the last one. I think we, yeah.
We're working.
Hey, FDO, a real girl. Raj Chaos again.
Hello,
Chaos. I realized in my last question I was kind of dumb and I forgot Murray Longworth's name, but I guess that's what happens when I've been hanging out with Gary Detweiler for too long.
It's all right. It's all right.
Anyway, I had one more question after finishing the final episode of Pandemic. Are we ever going to find out what happened to Bo-Pan after he left America, or is it just assumed
that we got these out of the triangle host gave birth to triangles? Yeah, Bo-Pan died.
Thanks. Keep being fucking awesome.
You know what? Bye. Let's talk about
dude. Let's talk about that part. Keep being fucking awesome.
I'll try that. I'll tell you two things. Number one, I was having a conversation with an elderly gentleman today in the streets of San Diego about my red wagon. I have a red wagon that folds up. And it unfolds and you put shit in it. Anyways, he was enamored with the red wagon. Why? Because he has one. He told me he can get his groceries in it and he doesn't have to get a car or an Uber. I thought that was great. And then finally, I'm like, need to separate from this guy. Talk about the red wagon. I'm like, hey man, you have a good one. And he goes, hey, you know what? It's going to be a great one. And I thought, here I was being full of hubris, not paying attention to my elders. And I'm like, that's the fucking attitude to have through life. Hey, you have a good one. You know what? It's going to be a great one. Not good, fucking great.
You know, that is so antithetical to your MO, though. It's awesome.
I know, right?
You're like, here's the thing. What do you, okay, what, are you coming at me? He's like, have a great day. And you're like, fuck yes, I'll have a great day.
Yeah, yeah. So now let's talk about Bo-Pan. Bo-Pan is a, there's an intentional character. Right now, depending on who you listen to or what side of the political spectrum you are on, US and China are enemies, in some regard, are enemies. But you just don't find people in any country ever who commit their entire life to their nation and don't believe in their nation. And it's really easy to be like, yeah, of course you can see American patriots, American spies. Yay, America. Let's go. Fucking people sacrifice to America all the time. Oh, look at that fucking Chinese guy. He's trying to sneak into America and get information. Because he's a fucking patriot, right? Or she's a patriot. And she has committed her life. She has sacrificed his or her own happiness to go do this thing for their country,
mm-hmm.
right? That is Bo-Pan. And the purpose of Bo-Pan in this trilogy is, great, let's take a look. And I'm by far, I'm not the only fucking guy to do this. There's a lot of authors do this. But you got to look at, here is the villain, the vehicle for the story. The thing that gets things moving in the story is a person that is not Western culture at all, and we would consider enemy because they are looking for a weapon to use against the West or a weapon to counter the West having that weapon. And Bo-Pan does every fucking thing he is supposed to do, gives up his entire life to be embedded in America so that when the time has come for him to be called upon to perform a task for his nation, he does it. He's fucking James Bond, a shorter, fatter James Bond.
He's either James Bond or the Manchurian Candidate. I think the Manchurian Candidate,
but he's like a little...
I mean, you don't think so, and he's a sleeper James Bond.
Oh, you saw Manchurian Candidate?
Well, when I read him, of course, and that's not him because that's not what you wrote him, so...
Mm-hmm.
But for me, he would have also... I mean, Steve is the stereotypical... Steve Stanton is like he could have lived his entire life not being called to service.
Correct.
And been totally oblivious and fine.
Yep.
But Pan understood his role as a person who may be called to service,
mm-hmm.
and yet got lilted into, oh, maybe we all learn something. Maybe we all change. Maybe it's not what I thought it was. Maybe it's not going to be I just got called in service and now I got to do this thing that I may or may not have the heart to do anymore. I just want to live my life. I'm not even done watching Stranger Things.
Yeah.
Like it's that moment that he has. Like he's like, I'm doing this because I said I'd do it. And that's, I'm a man of my word. But also you guys have noticed the whole universe has changed, right? That's what I felt like is happening to Bo-Pan. He's not the Americans. He's not like, let's do this.
Yeah, it's very gravitas. He's like, right? Shit, I got
He's like, I yeah, no, I mean,
punch
I'm,
the clock. Let's go to work.
I'm a man who is a man of my word and I'm going to do this. But are you fucking kidding me? This kid is 20. He's never seen the thing. He doesn't understand loyalty.
He's never been in China. He's well, no fucking
and you
shit.
Write that. That's the crazy part of that. You write exactly that into Steve Stanton. If you're Bo-Pan looking at Steve Stanton,
yep.
He's never been to China. He doesn't respect his parents. He mm-hmm. doesn't respect their choice to sacrifice themselves for their son.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't get any of that and he doesn't care about it. And those are all the things that Bo-Pan needs to believe that he should do the right thing for his country.
Mm-hmm.
Does his country care about him? do people respect the sacrifices his country has made? That's what happens between Beaupin, I think, looking at Steve Stanton and thinking of his own life. Mm-hmm. And yet he cannot walk away from the loyalty that he has pledged to his country, because that is the character of, that is the essentialness of the character he is.
And as an army brat, you kind of have a perspective on this, watching what people do for their country that impacts their family, impacts their descendants, themselves, et cetera. And it's not any fucking different. It's the same shit everywhere. There are dudes in the Venezuelan army right now, dudes and dudettes going through the same fucking thing. Oh, I got transferred again. I got to move my whole fucking family. It's Venezuela. There's no difference. There's slight differences in the efficiency and training of those armies, but the people in service to their nations all over the world are going through the exact same shit because they're just fucking people.
Yeah, and I think all the time we want to idealize the heroics, right?
So you want to idealize our own, yeah.
Well, and people who are being heroic in our own environment. And you want to, if you're Chinese and you look at Beaupin, he's sacrificing for his country even though he'd prefer not to, and that's heroic. Mm-hmm. And that's true, but I think it's kind of great and interesting to put that particular trueness, that particular truth, into a character who snots into his own hand and rubs it on his grimy ass sweater, yeah, and all that stuff, because, yeah, because you default to the idea that to be a hero means to be flawless and perfect. And in reality, we're all, at some moment in our lives, we're a hero in our own lives. Mm-hmm. And in some moment, we're a villain in our own lives. And in some moment, we're a bumblefucky, yeah, whatever in our
James
own lives.
James Bond also shits and farts and burps.
Exactly. And I think that's the thing about Beaupin, because he's really genuinely doing heroic work in a very workaday pedestrian way,
yeah,
for an ideology that we may or may not understand or espouse.
Right.
And I think that that's kind of unique, because every hero that you know of when you're growing up and understanding the idea of hero is flawless. And Beaupin is not
flawless.
Not unlike us.
Beaupin is tied for my secondary favorite character, along with Steve Stanton and Cooper Mitchell. But all these things, ma'am, I believe this is all the questions.
Yes.
So all of you people, and by you people, I mean you people, thank you so much for sending in your questions. A lot of you are sitting by the sidelines listening because you've participated in previous Q&As.
I'm going, oh my God, these people.
And you know all the things, and yet you're still listening. And if you're still listening right now and you're old guard, I would like you to just rub your back a little bit. Just pat yourself on the back a little bit.
I mean, you always say that at this point.
Smile for me. Smile.
To be fair, at this point in every Q&A, you say, we understand. And we really genuinely do. We might be making light of it right now, but we understand that you have one thing to do with that minute you spent with us.
Yeah.
You have one way to spend that time and you will never get it back.
Never
and
get
that
it back.
You spend mm-hmm. it listening to Scott's writing, you know, it really means the world to us.
Means the world to us. It's everything. It's our career. It's our life. It's why we exist. It's why we draw air. And you're awesome. But if you're new and you got your question answered, hey, welcome. Welcome, motherfuckers.
Join the Facebook group.
Sigler Junkies.
Sigler
That's
Junkies.
That's the hardcore. If you're listening at this point, go to Facebook.com. Search for Sigler Space Junkies. You will find people like you that you need to associate with. And do consider coming to Siglerfest. ScottSigler.com/Siglerfest. Thank you so much for listening to us blather for 2 hours about pandemic. It was super fun. I'm going to go to sleep now because this has been 20 years of my life to finish up this trilogy.
Yeah. And so before I light out of here and let you get to sleep, I would also like to say thank you so much to John Viscar and Mark for keeping track of us and keeping track of all the important questions.
Thank you. Super big
thanks to Steve Rickyberg, who made the production sound great in the podcast for all of you guys.
Mm-hmm.
And a great big, and I'm sure I'm forgetting other people, obviously all the
big
secret
thanks
agents.
Thanks to Ariok for all his work in the past.
Mm-hmm. Also Chris Grawl and J.P. Harvey and Scott Pond, who gave you information.
Don Mugavero,
Yeah.
Who lays out our books. There's just a shit ton of people. Shit ton of people.
So, and a big thanks to you for having gone through all that and then sat and answered all these picayune questions. And
I'm going to go get my P226 right now. I'm going to load up my 13-round magazine is what I want to do.
It's a 13.
I got a special.
Even sure it's a 12.
Bitches, I got a deal.
I don't think you get that. I don't think you
12.
Do 13.
I hope it's 12.
I know. It's a good question.
I thought that was the reason for the gun. It's because it's got the extended magazine. Instead of 10, you got 12. And you got with 13. You got one in fucking chamber.
That's a long time gone, that question. Although at least now you know that he sweats bullets over the bullets questions.
That's cool, man. That's cool.
So next up, we are going to do the Rider.
Yep. The Rider Rider's coming next week. Co-written with Paul E. Cooley. It's called a novella, but it's 80,000 words. It's a fucking novel, you guys.
Yeah.
Straight GFL Poughkeepsie Pete in all of his glory. It's going to be great. Oh, well, one last thing, then we'll go. You will see Poughkeepsie Pete in GFL Book 6.
Yeah.
Yes. Spoiler. Sorry. Okay. So thank you guys for hanging out all this time. We absolutely adore you. You're great. We've had 2 bottles of wine. We love the world right now.
Tomorrow, also, we've had a very busy May.
Very busy. Tomorrow, I'll sober up with a hangover. I will hate all you motherfuckers. I'll hate the world. I'll hate everything. And crusty, dark-hearted Scott will be back writing some more shit. And until then, we will talk to you all
real soon.
You have been listening to Pandemic, Book 3 of the Infected Trilogy, written by Scott Sigler, podcast engineered by Steve the Iceberg Ricky Berg. Follow Scott on Twitter and Instagram. His handle is @ScottSigler, or join our Facebook group, facebook.com/ScottSigler. Theme music is Believe in Goodbye by Uncrowned.